We as parents are required to perform two opposing tasks to protect our children who are dependent on us and simultaneously teach them to be independent and free of our control and competent to function independently. Children cannot start life independently. They are dependent on others for a very long period of time. We must protect and nurture human beings from infancy throughout their dependence, but to do so in a way that helps them become independent adults. Obviously, we cannot treat them as helpless if we want them to think of themselves as competent. We cannot prolong their submission and expect them to become autonomous. Yet, as we protect them and take care of them, we want at the same time to teach them to be free of our control and competent to function independently. Our own misgivings may direct us to keep them under our control so that they do not fall under the control of anyone else. We may mistake hovering for loving and act as if they will stay connected to us forever. At the same time, we know that they must be prepared for life apart from us. Sometimes we surround them with our love and concern in such a way that we actually fence them in. In our wiser moments, we realize that the only way our children can cope with a world in constant change is to learn early to make their own decisions, to feel confident of their own abilities, and to function under their own initiative. We want them to be able to do what they have to, even if no one is present to tell them what to do. In fact, we hope they will have the strength of character to resist the person or group that would tell them to do something in contradiction to the values we hold. Our objective in raising children, then, is to help them become sufficiently independent to cope with the challenges of life, to work and live in harmony with other people, and to enhance their own satisfaction in living. To achieve that state, children must be helped from the very beginning to function independently to the extent of their capacity. This means, as they grow and change, their capacity increases, and their freedom to function must also increase. Throughout childhood and into adolescence, they will swing from dependence to independence, sometimes to the dismay of their parents and other adults. The role of the adults is to foster the independence rather than the dependence, while providing for valid needs. It isn't always possible to know when a request or demand for attention is valid, but an effective yardstick can be used. Ask yourself, is this a reasonable request that the child cannot fulfill himself? The question does not always have a clear answer, but at least it helps to discover what is going on in the relationship between the child and the adult. The child who is learning to become independent can amuse himself, taking the responsibility for his own entertainment. He's a good companion who won't interrupt when an adult is occupied with in order to force the adult to notice him. Children can be very demanding, but that doesn't mean that parents or other adults must respond to every demand. In order for a child to learn what is expected, the adult response must be tailored to the situation. For the development of mutual respect, the parent must respect the child's absorption in play, and the child can learn to respect a parent's privacy. When the parent's response is calm, brief, and detached from the child's demands, the child will learn to limit those demands. In the absence of urgent needs, much of the annoying behavior of children is for the purpose of keeping the parents busy with them to get attention. When adults do not respond to such pressure, the annoying behavior abates. As a child grows in independence, he makes a growing contribution to the well-being of the family as a whole and learns to cooperate with the other family members and people outside the family. Such a child learns to give as well as to receive and to operate autonomously as well as in the group. Even the child who is learning to be independent will misbehave sometimes. As a matter of fact, what we call misbehavior is sometimes an experimentation of a young child to find out what is acceptable and what is not. We call it misbehavior when we feel upset. Our response then varies according to the intensity of our feelings at the moment, so that the child sometimes continues to test us to measure our response. Many people believe the best way to train a child is to reward him when he does something they like and punish him when he does something that they don't. And it is true that in this way they can shape a child's behavior. However, rewards and punishments can have undesirable side effects. The rewarded or punished child may become dependent and fearful, rebellious and antagonistic, sneaky and untruthful. As child training devices, rewards and punishments have serious flaws. They are not compatible with human dignity. They show lack of respect. They glorify force and power. A reward is often a bribe. A punishment is often revenge. They are examples of superior-inferior relationships. Frequently, punishment is given simply because the parent knows no other way of dealing with the child. Punishment can take many forms. Physical abuse, such as slapping or spanking. Verbal abuse, such as scolding or humiliating. Deprivation, such as being sent to bed without dinner and not being able to watch television. Isolation, being made to stay in one's room alone for a specific period of time. Or grounding, not being allowed to go out with friends. Here are some arguments against punishment. Punishment is usually an arbitrary exercise of power by the parent, who alone decides whether, when, and how much to punish. The parent becomes the prosecutor, jury, judge, and warden. The child may conclude that might is right and think that power is what counts. Punishment is often not logically related to the offense. If we tell a child that he cannot watch TV because he did not wash his hands, there's no logical relationship between the crime and the punishment. Punishment creates resentments because the child usually thinks the punishment was disproportionate to the offense. Punishment tends to create character defects because the child thereafter tries to avoid detection. He may begin to be sneaky and lie. The child may lose respect for order. If he is punished too lightly, he may try to get away with other offenses. After all, he may reason, the penalty isn't too bad. The child may try to get even. If he feels that he has been unfairly punished, he may try to get revenge by hurting himself, his parents, or both. Thus, often punished children usually become wild, rebellious, and delinquent. By punishing a child, you teach him that this is the way to treat others. He is likely to adopt punitive tactics against animals and other children. Punishment eventually has to be discontinued. When their child reaches a certain age, parents just have to give up this procedure. An attempt by a parent to punish a big child may result in a situation very ugly for both. At the moment, punishment may stop an objectionable behavior, but if the child stops only because fear of punishment, he is likely to refrain from that undesirable behavior only while the fear remains. He has not helped to develop inner controls for good behavior. Parents should not merely try to stop particular forms of misbehavior. Their primary goal should be to help the child become cooperative. Punishment not only exacts a heavy toll from the child, but seriously disrupts family harmony. Under some circumstances, a child may actually misbehave in order to obtain punishment. And the more often, the more quickly the parent punishes, the more often the child misbehaves. So what should we do if we don't punish or reward? Parents should always try first to obtain voluntary cooperation from their children by encouragement and by being cooperative themselves. If this fails, they can fall back on a method known as natural and logical consequences. This method is in accord with reality and helps to prepare the child for the ways in which nature and society are going to react to his behavior. The essence of natural consequences is to let the child learn from the experience. In relying on natural consequences, parents discover that nature is their best ally. A child who doesn't eat gets hungry. One who plays too hard gets tired. One who forgets to take money for a school lunch goes without. One who cheats at games finds himself without playmates. One who neglects his homework finds that his grades suffer. Parents must, of course, be alert to nullify any possible serious harm to the child. Certainly he cannot be permitted to fall out of a window or to eat poisonous substances. Natural consequences must be used with discretion. Parents have an obligation to inform the child once of the natural consequences of any specific behavior. If they keep reminding him, they are giving him unwarranted attention or punishing him by nagging. Parents should not feel that they are cruel when, within reasonable limits, they allow their child to experience the natural but unpleasant consequences of his behavior. Parents should not intervene between the child and reality, except in emergencies. What more can a parent do for a child than to help him learn the consequences he must face when he violates the laws of nature and society? Is there one of us who is not warned not to go near bees because they can sting? And yet, that one sting was enough of a lesson for a lifetime. Natural consequences are not enough to train a child. In many cases, parents need something more. The additional course of action may be called logical consequences. It is more effective than punishment and has none of punishment's drawbacks. It requires an understanding between the parent and child as to what is expected from the child and what is to happen if the child does not perform as expected or misbehaves. What happens then must be a logical consequence to the child's conduct. Here are some examples of parental statements illustrating the technique of logical consequences. Unless you agree to act properly at the supermarket, I will not take you. If you lose your money, I will not give you any more. If you break the window playing ball, you will have to pay for a replacement. If you don't eat at lunchtime, you cannot eat until supper. When the understanding is clear and consistently followed, the child cannot feel that the parent is being unfair to him, and so he harbors no resentment. Some parents frequently find themselves arguing with the hope of persuading him to stop unwanted behavior. They do not realize that ignoring or withdrawing from a child's misbehavior is a better way to teach than talking. Let's suppose that you are reading a newspaper and that your child persists in begging you to play with him. You feel tired, and this is not his time for playing with you. You have already told him so, but he continues to whine. Leave the room and go somewhere else to finish reading your paper. Parents sometimes think that withdrawing from a child's tyrannical behavior is the same as defeat or running away from the situation. It is not. Withdrawal here simply means going from a spot where there is trouble to a spot where there is none. It gives this message: when I don't like what you do, I go away from you. When we use withdrawal as a training technique, we must be careful to indicate that we are not fleeing from the individual, but rather from his behavior. Leaving the child can be an effective means of discouraging annoying behavior, no matter what his goal may be. If he is acting silly to get attention, if he is trying to initiate an argument to show his power, if he is pretending disability in order to get you to do things for him, if he is having a temper tantrum, often all you need do is ignore him or withdraw from him. In this simple way, you terminate the child's useless behavior and teach him that it will not work. Parents often wonder why withdrawal is so effective. The child's behavior is purposive. He wants to get you involved against your will. And if you resort to punishment, you have become involved. But if you vanish, you do not become involved, and you frustrate the child's attempt to force his goal-oriented behavior on you. Encouragement is a nourishment of the soul, just as food is the nourishment of the body. Any uncooperative child is likely to be a discouraged one. A discouraged person is usually convinced that he is not as adequate as others. He often gives up without even trying. Unwittingly, parents frequently discourage this child. In their very attempts to encourage him, they may achieve just the opposite result. Here are some examples of how parents may discourage the child before the particular behavior happens. They may say, "Let me do it for you," or, "If younger children can do it, so can you," or, Look at how well your brother does it. Discouraging statements after the behavior include comments like, I shouldn't have trusted you. I've told you 1,000 times. When will you learn? I'm so ashamed of you. Wait till your father gets home. You'll be sorry when I'm dead. Normal parents who love their children frequently talk this way. They want their remarks to make him try harder, and in the immediate situation this may happen. To get his parents' approval, the child may make a special effort. However, negative parental remarks do not work in the long run. If the child gets a steady diet of discouraging remarks, he eventually feels, what's the use? I can't do things. I can't win. I can never satisfy them. Everyone does better than I do. I won't try anymore. Encouragement implies faith in the child and communicates your belief in his strength and ability. Parents easily see their child's weak points. They should look hard to find his strong points. No matter how trivial those may seem, it's wise to let him know that they are appreciated. It's difficult for a parent when they're irritated to see the child's good qualities. At such a time, it's important to rise above the irritation and to say positive rather than negative things to the child. Always there is at least some small point upon which the parents can focus an encouraging remark. It may be something such as, you made a good effort, or I think you did a little better than last time. Good for you. There are some dangers of praise, for praise may or may not be encouraging. Lavish praise usually seems insincere. The child may feel that he is not worthy of it. Praise may actually discourage a child if he fears that the next time he may not be able to live up to it. One praises when a job is well done, but when a child does poorly, he needs encouragement much more than he does when he does well. There are some definite ways to distinguish between praise and encouragement. Praise is given to the doer. You are a good boy for drawing such a nice picture for me. Encouragement is given for the deed. That's a pretty picture. Or, I'm sure you enjoyed drawing that. Praise is given for work well done. What good grades you brought home. Encouragement is also given when work is done poorly. So what? We all make mistakes. I'm sure you'll do better next time. Praise implies a demand for continued high performance. Encouragement makes no demands. Praise often seems phony. Encouragement is sincere. Praise may not increase self-esteem. Encouragement fosters self-esteem. There are some ways to encourage your child. Build on his strong points. Look for good things, including his efforts. Do not emphasize his liabilities. Don't criticize, nag, or complain about what he should have done. Show your appreciation by saying things as, thanks for setting the table. I appreciate your help. Be friendly. A friend shares and listens and says, you seem troubled. Do you want to talk? Show your affection. A kiss, a hug, or an arm around the shoulder causes a child to feel that you like him. Suggest small steps in doing a task. The entire job may seem too big. If he's a finicky eater, let him take small portions, and then he'll be encouraged in asking for seconds. Spend time with the child in play. Through play, you can build a good relationship. Use humor. A wink, a pun, or a laugh at oneself can warm the relationship. Always laugh with the child, not at him, and let him laugh with you at the crazy mistakes you make, too. Notice an attempt to do a job. Recognize his effort, even if the job is not well done. Become fully aware of the interaction between you and your child. He will at times provoke your anger by testing you to the limits of your endurance. At such times, it is best not to show anger, but just walk away and stay away until you cool off. Remember, you're the adult here. When you both are calm, tell him that such behavior angers you. Learn to depend on the method of natural consequences. Allow the child to solve his own problems. Don't be on his back at all times. Give him the widest latitude possible in attending to his own needs and concerns. Accept the child as he is. The more emphatically you do so, the more emphatically you tell him, "I like you." Try to see the world from the child's point of view. And don't forget that you yourself can sometimes be wrong. Have faith in your child. Who knows what he may become? The kid who isn't doing his homework, who gets into things, who doesn't want to go to bed on time, who messes up his room, who fights with his brothers and sisters. He has the capability and potential of being a fine success someday in any endeavor he may choose. Be an optimistic person yourself. Attitudes are contagious. Is yours worth catching? So by now you may be thinking, how can I change my patterns of raising children? That's not the question. The question is, how can I possibly keep doing what I'm doing if it doesn't make sense or if it isn't producing the desired results? When you're the navigator on any kind of a journey, you have to figure out where you are before you can know which direction to follow. So it is with raising children. First, find out where you are, choose what to do, and watch where you arrive. Now that you see the possibilities, stop to evaluate where you are. Are you leading your children toward independence, or are you unknowingly following the road toward their continued dependence? Life is movement, and there's always another chance to move in the direction you want to go. There's always some one thing you can do that will help your children become independent. Choose one at a time and enjoy the results. On this side of the tape, we will integrate, assimilate, and apply the principles that you just heard. A word of caution before we begin. Never play this side of the tape in a moving car, for this is a relaxation tape and designed to put you into a relaxed state of mind. So never play this tape when you are to maintain concentration in the awakening state. Make yourself comfortable, being sure your clothing is loose. It makes no difference whether you sit up or lie down, as long as you are in a comfortable position. Fix your gaze on something. While you watch it, let your eyes go out of focus if you can. Now take a deep breath that helps you relax. Soon you will find you are more relaxed than you probably have ever been before. Just relax and let go. Soon your eyelids will begin to feel rather heavy. As you continue to look at the object you've selected, the eyelids will get heavier and heavier, heavier and heavier. Probably you will begin to blink a bit. There may be a slight watering of your eyes as the eye muscles relax more and more. The lids are getting heavier and heavier. Let them wink if they seem to want to wink. Let them close whenever they want to close. The lids are relaxing more and more, which is why they feel so heavy and want to wink. Soon they will want to close. The lids are relaxing soon they will want to close. Let them close whenever you want to. They are so heavy, getting still heavier. It's even hard to keep them open. Take another deep breath now. Let your eyes close if they are not already closed. In a moment, you may find that you need to swallow. Swallow whenever you feel the need. Probably you are developing a listless, drowsy feeling. Drowsy and rather sleepy. Very drowsy, and you feel more and more drowsy as you relax still more. You can relax more now. Begin with your right leg Make all the muscles taut. Wiggle the toes. Stretch the muscles in your calf and upper leg by moving your foot. Then let the muscles loosen up and go limp from your toes right up to your hip. Now do the same with your left leg, tightening all the muscles, then letting them go loose. Relax the whole leg from the toes to the hip. Your body can relax more now. Let your stomach and abdominal muscles loosen. Then your chest and breathing muscles. The muscles of your back can loosen and be limp. Let them loosen completely. Now your shoulders and the neck muscles. Often we have tension in that area. Feel the tension going out of those muscles as they loosen. And now make your right arm stiff and rigid. Then let it go completely relaxed. Let all the muscles go slack from your shoulder right down to your fingertips. Your arm will relax completely. In the same way, relax your left arm. Even your facial muscles will relax. Notice how comfortable you feel. All tension is leaving you, draining away. You are so very comfortable and drowsy now. You will listen attentively to what is being said. If there are outside noises, you need pay no attention to them. They go in one ear and out the other. They are unimportant. Listen only to my voice. Often there is a flickering of the eyelids when you are relaxed. It's one of the signs of relaxation. Sometimes they do not flicker. If yours do, they will soon relax and stop fluttering as you sink deeper and deeper. Take still another deep breath and let yourself go completely. Enjoy the dreamy, drowsy feeling. You feel so very drowsy, but you are fully aware. Such a comfortable, pleasant listlessness is creeping over you more and more as you relax so completely. Perhaps your whole body feels heavy, particularly your arms and legs. Notice that your breathing has changed. You are breathing more from the bottom of your lungs, abdominal breathing, and you are breathing more slowly. Notice the feeling of comfort and well-being which has come over you. Give way to the listless drowsiness. Everyone enjoys this. It's so comfortable and pleasant. Your whole body is relaxed and tensions seem to drain away. Now you can still go deeper into this pleasant state. Let go and go deeper and deeper with each breath. Deeper and deeper. The deeper you go, the more comfortable and pleasant it seems. Now imagine that you are standing at the top of an escalator, such as are in some stores. See the steps moving down in front of you, and see the railings. If you do not like to ride escalators, imagine a staircase instead. I will count backwards from 10 to 0. If you are using the escalator, step on it as I begin to count, standing with your hand on the railing. Or if you use the staircase, start walking slowly down as I count. You are all alone. It is your private escalator. When we reach 0, imagine you have reached the bottom and step off. 10, and you step on. Each count will take you deeper and deeper. 9, 8, 7, 6. You are going deeper. deeper. Two. One. And zero. Now step off the escalator or staircase. You can continue to go deeper with each breath you take. Often in our child rearing, we become so emotionally involved and so upset by circumstances. So relax in any way you can to calm down your mind and your body. It may be effective for you to count from 10 to 1 with feelings of peace, calmness, and joy. Imagine that you inhale peace and relaxation and exhale all tension and anxiety. As you continue, now to float in this very comfortable and safe place, I'm going to talk directly to your mind. Your subconscious mind is the part of you that is the storehouse of your strength, your creativity and knowledge, and all of your vast resources. As such, it has access to much more than your mere conscious mind ever could. Your subconscious mind knows what changes you need to make to release your blocks and grow fully as a human being and a loving parent, and it knows how best to make these changes. If you are not ready to face certain information, then your subconscious mind will not send such information to you. So feel safe in this process. Your subconscious mind is very wise. Know also that your subconscious mind often thinks in symbols and images rather than in words. So do not anticipate certain things happening. Just allow whatever occurs to be. It is just exactly right, exactly what you need. I'd like to ask your subconscious mind now to choose something of importance for you to do as a person to help you grow and become more effective with your children. Perhaps to begin the process of changing something that needs to be changed. Perhaps to send your conscious mind information that you need to face. Perhaps to rest deeply and comfortably within yourself to refresh and rejuvenate all that is in you. Allow your subconscious mind to choose for you what needs to be done now, and trust the process. Trust that the deeper part of your mind to know and to do that which is most beneficial to you now. This process need not be a conscious one. Trust that what needs to be done is being done, and allow yourself to flow with the process. Now I'd like to ask your subconscious mind to do something of importance to help you as a person and as a loving parent. During this time, visualize a perfect relationship with your children. With good communication, with a lot of love and concern being expressed for them. Thank you. Take a few minutes now to complete what you have begun today, knowing that the process you have begun will continue at the subconscious level throughout the hours and the days ahead, continuing to influence you and to help you. I'd also like to ask your subconscious mind now to prepare you over the hours and the days ahead for the next changes that need to be made within you, and then, in a totally appropriate time and manner, to do whatever needs to be done. Know this, that when you are ready, whatever needs to be done will be done. You have begun the process. Your subconscious mind will complete it for you. Trust your mind. Trust this process. Gibran says, your children are not your children. They are the sons and daughters of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not from you, and though they are with you, yet they belong not to you. You may give them your love, but not your thoughts, for they have their own thoughts. You may house their bodies, but not their souls, for their souls dwell in the house of tomorrow, which you cannot visit, not even in your dreams. You may strive to be like them, but seek not to make them like you, for life goes not backward, nor tarries with yesterday. You are the bows from which your children, as living arrows, are sent forth. The archer sees the mark upon the path of the infinite, and he bends you with his might, that his arrows may go swift and far. Let your bending in the archer's hand be for gladness, for even as he loves the arrow that flies, so he also loves the bow that is stable. Now when you return to normal waking consciousness, bring with you the feelings of inner peace and calmness, of a quiet joy spreading throughout your being and emanating out into your relationships with others and especially your children. And now in your own time and in your own way, return all the way back to normal waking consciousness, wide awake, alert, enthusiastic and energetic, feeling better than you've ever felt before, with a full determination to allow your true self be expressed in your relationship with your children.